Would you take your Bible, please, and turn to the Gospel of Genesis, the book of Genesis, chapter 50. Genesis, chapter 50. Genesis, chapter 50. Again, I'm reading from the New International Version, beginning at verse 15 down to verse 21. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph, saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of God of your father." When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Funerals are never the best of times for any family. And for many families, often funerals have a way of bringing to the surface problems that have been in that family for many, many years. And especially if a mom or a dad is the one who's passed away. The patriarch, Jacob, is dead. It was a first-class funeral, only like the Egyptians can do. The Egyptian morticians were able to do something pretty astounding. They turned Joseph's daddy into a mummy. Think about it. Thank you. And with all the elaborate procedures of the first part of this chapter, when it finally sinks into the brothers that their father is dead, they're quite concerned. And they're concerned about themselves and their relationship to Joseph, their brother. As we look at our text tonight, we want to see it in the light of two things. First of all, the brothers' request. Secondly, Joseph's response. The brothers' request. There's no doubt that Jacob sinned. He sinned by having favorites. He had a favorite wife, and out of that, he had a favorite son. And Joseph, indeed, was his favorite pet. He gave him that special coat. He treated him with a special dignity and authority. And invariably, and I suppose inevitably, it was bound to cause problems for the rest of this pretty dysfunctional family. Four different mothers, brothers out of these four different mothers, all living together in the same intense situation. I got to keep you awake till John gets here, so. Eventually, they react in a pretty violent way to their brother. They endeavor to get rid of him, to get him out of their lives, to get his strange and weird and wonderful dreams out of their lives. First planning to kill him, they then decide to sell him as a slave, and he is taken into Egypt. And now, after many, many years, their father is dead, and they're concerned, what will Joseph do? It seems very obvious to them that the only reason that Joseph hasn't retaliated so far is because he intensely loved his father, Jacob. And he obviously would do nothing to hurt Jacob, therefore he would not hurt Jacob's other sons. But Jacob is dead now. He's gone to be with his forefathers, Abraham and Isaac. And the brothers are quite concerned that now that Jacob is out of the picture, Joseph, with his position of power and authority, will get revenge. He will pay them back. And so they concoct this story, this lie, that before Jacob died, probably on his deathbed, he gave the 10 brothers a message that they were to give to Joseph. And this is the message. It's found in verse 17. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I, Jacob, your father, ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and wrongdoings they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of God of your father. Twice in that message, Jacob supposedly is asking Joseph to forgive his 10 brothers. Now, what the brothers were concerned about was found in verse 15. What if Joseph holds a grudge against us? Now, that word holds a grudge, there's a very interesting word. It's found three times in chapter 37 of Genesis, in verse 4, verse 5, and verse 8. And each time it says, and they hated Joseph. They hated Joseph. They hated Joseph. It's amazing how we often assume that how we feel about people is how they'll feel about us. And they're very, very concerned that now that Jacob is dead, that Joseph will now outwardly express his hatred towards his 10 brothers. And as the text says in verse 15, they will pay them back. He will get even. He will get revenge. And so they concoct this story that for your father's sake, will you please forgive your brothers for the sins and the wrongdoings that they've committed against you? That was their request. Well, when you think about it, you can imagine why they might feel a little bit apprehensive about their situation now that their father is dead. Joseph was 17-something when he was sold into slavery. He doesn't resurface again until he's 30. 12 to 13 years of his life, prime years of his life, were spent either as a slave or as a prisoner. He's taken into a foreign country. He's first made a household domestic slave, and of course he rises to a position of head slave in that home. Then he's continually seduced and lured and enticed by Potiphar's wife. He is faithful to God. He refuses to sin. And then she makes up and fabricates this case of rape. She even has the cloak to prove it. And her husband comes home and he throws innocent Joseph into jail. And there again, he's a prisoner and he becomes a slave in the prison. And for 12 or so years, he is grinding it out. He is existing. He is living. He's doing anything but what he really wanted to do. And it seems he's doing anything but what the promises of God said he would do. That he indeed would reign and his brothers would bow down before him. And they can only imagine how they would have felt if that had happened to them. They would be angry. They would hold a grudge. They would want to get revenge. We live at a time in our society where we hear a lot of horror stories. A lot of terrible things happen to people. You don't need to be in the ministry very long, and you don't need to be even a believer very long until you begin to hear of some of the things that the children of God have gone through. Maybe in their own homes, maybe in other experiences. And some of those things are almost unbelievable, except you know they're true by the pain and the heartache and the aging of the people who have gone through them. Where society is very preoccupied with being victims, of trying to somehow deal with all of the things that have happened to us, that have shaped us, informed us, and affected us adversely as we've gone through our lives. And of course, some people are making a fortune as they listen to the tales of woes of other people, whether it was their parents or a teacher or a Boy Scout leader or whoever it might have been. And it seems like these experiences just cripple people, just handicap them. It's almost like for the rest of their life, they're driving with an emergency brake on in their car. And you would think if anybody was going to be bitter, it would be Joseph. And you would think if anybody is going to exact revenge, it would be Joseph, because few people in history have been treated so badly as Joseph was, and few people in history have risen to such a position of power and prominence and authority as Joseph had. And these brothers were scared silly as they were having the finger sandwiches and sipping the tea at the little gathering after the funeral. They were afraid that now that Dad was gone, they were going to get it. That he would pay them back. He would get revenge. He would carry out his grudge. He would express his hatred. And so the brothers come with this concocted request. Please, for your father's sake, forgive your brothers. Joseph's response. Before we get to Joseph's response, what would your response have been? But maybe even a little more personal. What is your response right now to the things that have happened to you? Maybe it's that church you used to pastor. Maybe it's that elder or that deacon or that pastor. Maybe it's a former wife, or maybe it's a best friend, or maybe... How have you responded to that? And especially when you think of this whole thing of forgiving. Twice he is asked to forgive his brothers. And boy, that's hard to do, isn't it? Because you see, to forgive people, if you really understand it biblically, really means to let them go free and to not hold their sin against them. It really means that you will not hold them accountable and liable for that which they've done to you. And that's why it's hard to forgive. Because there's something about it that does not seem right. It doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem just. And if we're a believer, a child of God, we're caught in this dilemma of knowing that we should forgive, but wrestling with doing it. And often what we think is, well, maybe if I have enough counseling or enough therapy or if I'm in the right recovery group, I will be able to eventually do this. I will be eventually able to let go of this. But that isn't what we need. How did Joseph respond? Well, the first thing we notice in verse 17 at the end is that he wept. Who do you think he was crying for? Himself? Do you think eventually after 12 or so years, or at this point, who knows how many years it's been? There's been 7 years of good, so he was 37. There's been 7 years of famine, so he's 44 and however much longer. Was it just kind of a final release of all the pent-upness of the bitterness and the anger and the frustration and the confusion why his own parents, his own brothers would do that to him? Was he crying for himself? No. He was crying for them. He was weeping for them because they still, after all these years, didn't really get it. They still didn't really get it. And so in emotion, he weeps. His brothers come and they throw themselves, in a sense, down at his feet. And they say, "We will be your slaves." I wonder where they got that from. They're assuming that the only way to get revenge is to become what you did to the other person. He was sold by them as a slave, and they figure the only way to make this thing right is for them to become his slaves. But Joseph knows, and you and I know, that that never solves anything, does it? It doesn't produce forgiveness. It doesn't produce satisfaction. It doesn't produce even paying back. And Joseph, in verse 19, amazingly says, and I'm sure he went like that and said, "Don't be afraid." Now that's astounding too. Because the most difficult thing about being in an abusive situation is the fear. The sense that you are not in control, that things are out of your control and somebody else's control, and there's really not a lot you can do about it. You can only be afraid. When he was in that empty cistern, there wasn't much he could do about it. The psalmist says that he cried out to them and they wouldn't even listen to his cries for help. And then I'm sure when he was grabbed and dragged out of there and put on a camel or something by those Midianites and taken down into Egypt, there wasn't a lot he could do about it. And then he's on the slave market and people are coming and pinching him and checking him out. And this security agent for the Pharaoh, the secret police, he says, I'll take the Hebrew fellow there. And then he's put into a situation, not knowing a language, a culture, and no doubt starting out by cleaning the toilets and sweeping the floor and feeding the camels, whatever. And then being holy before God and caught in this trap with Potiphar's wife and thrown into prison. He probably knew a lot about fear. Because you see, that's how the world works. It intimidates. It dominates, it scares, it frightens. It makes people afraid. And Joseph says, "You don't need to be afraid of me." Now, how can Joseph say all this and do all of this? Just had good therapy? He was in a slave recovery group. A 12-step program for prison wardens? No. You see, the way you see your life will be determined by the way you see God in your life. Joseph does not need to get revenge. He does not need to pay back. Joseph is freed up to forgive because of two truths about God. And that's what we want to notice in terms of his reply and his response to their request to forgive. First of all, in verse 19, he asked a rhetorical question. That is a question where the answer is in the question. I'll give you an example. I'm good looking, aren't I? Thank you. Right answer. Where's the ushers? He asked this rhetorical question. Am I in the place of God? Now that question was asked earlier actually by Joseph's daddy, Jacob, in 30 verse 2. Rachel was not getting pregnant. And she was getting frustrated. And she got mad one day at Jacob and she said, "Give me children or I'll die." And Jacob said to her, "Am I in the place of God that I can give children?" You see, there's only certain things that God can do. And one of them, obviously, is that he determines when life will be created. This is really the question that's being asked in Genesis chapter 3. That's the bait, it's the lure from Satan to Eve. That you can be in the place of God, that you can determine what is right and what is wrong. And she fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, and of course she found out that's the last place she wound up being, was in the place of God. You see, there's only certain things There are certain things I should say that only God can do. In Genesis 30, verse 2, He is the one who gives life, even in the womb. In Genesis 3, in the first few verses there, it is He, God alone, who determines what is right and what is wrong. Neither of those things are left to the creature to determine. And it seems now that there's a third thing that is not left to the creature to carry out. Only God has the right to get revenge and pay back. Isn't that true? Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. I am to repay the evil done to me with good. And the reason being that if I seek to exact payment or revenge or get even on people, I am usurping the position and the place of God. And Joseph said, I can't do that. Do you remember when he was tempted by Potiphar's wife? He says, how can I do this and sin against God? And see, as he looks at this whole issue of giving forgiveness to people, he realizes that he really has no choice but to give forgiveness, because any other thing that is to be given must be given by God. And we'll see what God gave in a couple of minutes. So his first answer to them is, listen, I am not God. I am not in the position or the place. I do not have the authority or the power or the right to exact from you the kind of punishment that should be given with your treatment of me. So I will leave that with God. So the first response is, well, you don't need to be afraid. You don't need to worry about what I'm going to do to you, because to do something to you in any way other than forgiveness is God's right to do. The second thing he says, and that has to do with God as well, he says, you don't seem to understand. I don't need to get revenge. I don't need to pay you back. I don't need to get even, because, in verse 20, you intended to harm me. He calls a spade a spade. He doesn't say, oh, well, you know, we all came from a dysfunctional family. Half the time we didn't know who our mother was. And you know, Dad, he was out busy. He had all these sheep and camel and goats and everything like that. And no wonder he probably didn't want to come home at night, you know. And, you know, we had a pretty messed up childhood, didn't we? Remember that time, Simeon, and remember when you went over to Shechem there? And you know, remember what happened to Dinah? Boy, that was hard on us. And do you remember? No. He says, I'll be very honest with you. You intended to harm me. But God intended it. God did not intend good for Joseph. He intended it. He intended what they intended to do in harming him. He intended that very thing to do good. Now, that word good there is an interesting word. It's the word tov, like T-O-V. It's found a number of times in Genesis chapter 1. And God saw what he had made, and it was good. Saw, and it was good. And at the end, he saw, and behold, it was very good. That is, that everything that God formed and fashioned during those 6 days carried out what it was intended to do. Whether it was trees or birds or reptiles or whatever it might be. And what it was intended to do was this, that everything would bring glory to God and everything would bring good to God's people. It was very good. The world that was formed and fashioned by the word of God brought him praise and glory. The trees clapped for joy. The rivers sang his praises, the birds and all of the animals, everything just sparkled with the radiance of the glory of God. And everything was good for Adam and Eve. meeting all of their legitimate needs and ministering to them in such a way that it would cause them to worship and praise and be thankful to God, who is the giver of every good and perfect gift. Then something happened in chapter 3. Eve thought and Adam thought they could do gooder than God could. They could make this even gooder still. And of course, they couldn't. And who would ever think after chapter 3 of Genesis we would ever see the word good again in the Bible? Because sin is now ruling and reigning. Sin is impacting on the environment and the and even the very existence and eking out food to eat. Sin is now affecting the relationship between Adam and Eve, between Cain and Abel, between the nations and all of these things. Sin is everywhere bringing evil and bad and harmful. And yet the astounding thing is the God who made all of this in the beginning and pronounced it good is still able to say, this will be good. That is, God will use this situation to bring himself unspeakable glory and praise and of unspeakable blessing and salvation to the people involved. Notice what he says. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, which is the saving of many lives. And of course, you know the story in terms of the 7 good years of prosperity and bounty and the 7 famine years. And God providentially arranged all of this so that Joseph, his man, would be in his place at his time. And out of that, God is going to carry out this marvelous promise of the seed and the preserving of a seed from Genesis 3. And a motley crew is going to come to Egypt. And there they're going to be preserved and protected. And as Paul Harvey would say, and then the rest of the story. You see, God's intention is always in doing good and bringing salvation. Now, just practically in our own experience, what that means is that as I look back over my life and I see the things that have occurred in my life, I am to see that they were evil or harmful or bad. That certain people, without being, you know, kind of paranoid, certain people certainly intended to do hurt and to do harm. But the neat thing about the Bible is that God had the first say and he has the last say. Oh, people devise their plans and their schemes, don't they? But it's the purposes of God that are accomplished. And you see, as Joseph looks at his life and he sees where he is today, where he sees where God has placed him and how God has brought so immeasurable, amazing, astounding things in fulfilling his promises of those dreams back in chapter 37, why would Joseph want revenge? Why would he want to get even? Because although it was painful, and it hurt, it was unfair, it was unjust, it was cruel, it was unkind, it was all worked together for good. And that's all he needs to know. Now, I don't know how God does it. He is good. He is absolutely holy and righteous and just. And yet, since Genesis 3, this good and holy God has been taking sinful things done by sinful people, working in his sinful creatures that he's saving, and the end result is they'll be as holy as his son. Can you figure that out? That's amazing. You see, God could have done magic tricks. He could have just kind of made, I guess, everything disappear and start over again. But what is astounding about God and his sovereignty in terms of this fallen world and the salvation and the good that he's intended for his people, and remember, an innumerable host that no one can number, is that he has taken all of this fallenness and all of the terribleness and all of the sin of this world and all the sinful people of this world and taken sinners like his children, and he has constantly brought to bear in their lives sin without being the author of it. And when he is through with them, they are holy. Isn't that astounding? You look at your own experience. When have you grown the most? Or when should you have grown the most? When do you pray best? What's been the most fruitful part of your ministry? And invariably it has come out of the bad, that which was intended for harm or for evil. And I just can look at my own experience and I can think of the home I grew up. I think of physical handicap. I think of a number of other things. And at the time you think, why? Why? And yet I cannot count the number of times that those things have been the things that I've been able to share with other people and say, listen, God has brought me through this and he can bring you through it. And he's intended this for my good. He's intended this for my salvation. He's intended this for my own conversion. I was made to go to Sunday school so my parents could have a little sanity for an hour and a half. They had 3 boys in 5 years. That was the insane part. And we lived in a small 2-bedroom house. And this local Baptist church had a bus ministry. My parents weren't believers, but they weren't stupid. And they thought if we put our kids on that bus, we may get an hour or so peace on a Sunday morning, because it is, after all, the day of rest. I went there from the time I was 8 to 17, heard the gospel, remember being convicted a number of times, felt very sure I needed to be saved, felt even more sure that's the last thing I wanted to be. You see, I wanted to be a professional musician. And I didn't really think that that was probably what God had in mind. And I thought, if I ever get saved, he's going to mess up my life. He did. My father taught me music. He was a music teacher. I have no idea why he'd get mad at me, but he periodically did. And I'm sure I provoked him to wrath the odd time. But one day, he got mad and broke my clarinet. And that was devastating to me. Around that time, one of my best friends got encephalitis, went into a sleeping coma. His mother was a Christian. He was in the hospital. They didn't know if he would live or not. But the doctor came up with this brilliant idea that if maybe his goofy friends came up to visit him, he might come out of his coma. And so his mother would drag me to the hospital and I'd sit there talking to this vegetable about baseball. Well, I wasn't there for his sake. You know what his mother was doing? She was telling the nurses how good the Lord was. And she loved her boy. And she was telling the doctors how good the Lord was. And she was telling me how good the Lord was. And I thought, boy, that's strange. This guy's a vegetable. And all she can say is how good the Lord was. Now, I'm 17, and, you know, she's, well, you know, anybody past 20 when you're 17 is kind of old. And I'm thinking, this gal's weird. This is nuts. This is crazy. But you know what I did? She never told me. She didn't say, you know, God had a wonderful plan for your life. She just told me that God was good and he does all things well. And I went home and I got out my King James Bible and I started to read it. I thought, wow, that's some kind of a God. Now, my father was very opposed to the gospel, so I'd go into the bathroom and read the Bible. And being sound in hermeneutic and exegesis, I just kind of go like this and open the Bible and I'd start reading. And I'd read about sheep and goats and things like that, and I thought, man, this is wackier than she is. And so, the next day, I'd be back at the bathroom. I'd open the Bible again, and some guy was on a roof, and a sheet came down, and there was all these animals in it. And I thought, this stuff is weird. I have no... And I'm 17, I'm in grade 12. Like, if you're cool, you're cool in grade 12. The next day I was back again, and back again. And in Canada, we have Thanksgiving at the right time of the year, in October. And day after day, I read that word. And I don't know the hour or the day. I know the place. I'm the John. But, hey, that's holy ground. I mean it. And by our Thanksgiving, I was converted. What a strange God, eh? Now, that fella came out of his coma. We're best friends to this day. I wonder why the Lord did that. Even if it was just for some goofy guy in grade 12, he has ways of doing things to bring salvation, doesn't he? What a gospel. And you see, Joseph's looking at his life, and he's looking at the bigger picture, and he's saying, what, me get revenge? When you see all this, when you see what God has done and what he is doing and what he will do, I'm going to get even? I'm going to go to a psychiatrist's couch and tell them what a rotter my father was because he broke my clarinet? That was my God. It was my idol. I didn't know it. And God used a sinful man to do a sinful thing to take a sinner like me to Jesus. Absolutely astounding. And he does it all the time, all through history. I must be doing pretty good. Fred's getting the offering buckets. That's always a good sign. Now, let me just say to you, if you don't see God in these two ways, you won't forgive. Because invariably you will say that what people have done to you has been lost to you. They have taken good years from you. They've taken your innocence from you. They've taken your childhood from you. They've taken the enjoyment of the Lord from you. They have and see, if you see it in any other way, because those things are precious and good and right in themselves, you will want to get even. Unless you see that in your life, from beginning to end and all the way through, is a good and a holy God who knows exactly what he's doing. I was 17, and I can remember going to bed at night praying that God would kill my father. And God used my father in the salvation of my soul. What a marvelous God. And all down through history, we see time and time and time again. Have you really read the book of Genesis? Have you seen all the bad and the sin and the ugly? It's obvious to me that God doesn't save good people. Any of you gals want Abraham for a husband? Every time he goes cross-border shopping, he tells them that you're his sister. Because he's afraid of the Americans, they like pretty women. This is a Canadian perspective, of course. Would you want Isaac as your father? What clear word from God while they're yet in the womb, when they're looking at the ultrasound, when they're looking at the pictures. God says the younger will be over the elder. And so what does Isaac do? Try to make the elder, the one who will have the promises and the blessings. And then when you come to Jacob, where does it start and where does it end? If it wasn't so sad, it would be a comedy of errors. This and that and the other thing and all of the bungling and everything else. You see, God's into dysfunctional people and dysfunctional things. Not many wise, not many great, not many noble, not many people who got it all together get in heaven. Oh, there's the odd one because God's gracious. But oh, he picks messed up people in a messed up world with messed up lives. And he says, do you see all that mess? When I'm through with you, you will look like my son. And on that great day, nobody will even say, but God, why did you do that? Why did you allow that? We will just fall in worship. We will have nothing to ask because it is clear that the things that were most crucial in conforming me to the likeness of Jesus Christ was that which was suffering and pain and hardship and injustice and unfairness and all of those things, because those are the things that formed and fashioned Jesus, weren't they? So what's his response? You see, you can have good theological arguments and still be in a snit with people. He gives him his theological explanation in verse 19 and 20, and then in verse 21 he says, so then, he drops the other shoe. He says, this is how my theology of the sovereignty of God will practically affect you. It will determine how I treat you. I will provide for you and your children. And it will determine how I talk to you. I will speak kindly to you. Now, if you go back to Genesis 37, you will see that they spoke harshly to Joseph. You see, if you don't have a sovereign God who's working everything together for good, you got to make it work. And you've got to use harsh words and fear tactics and all of these kinds of things. You have to force and impose and all of those things. But oh, when you have Almighty God, who has all power and who is everywhere and knows everything and sees everything, he's already determined the end from the beginning. He doesn't have to run from here back to Hamilton to make sure this works out for Don. He's already there, as we learned last night. Then you're freed up. You're freed up to forgive, to treat kindly, to talk kindly, to be like Jesus Christ. What a gospel. You see, only God can do that. You can have all the counseling and the psychology and everything else you want, but it's only theology that gets your head right. But it's not just head theology, it's personal theology. So that this stuff is transforming you from the inside out, and it's flushing your rad clean, and it's working in you both to will and to do of his good purpose, so that when you see, like a Corrie ten Boom sees the guard who was responsible for the death of her sister, she can forgive. Joseph can forgive his brothers and be kind to them and talk kind to them. Because, you see, God's in the business of saving people. And it doesn't get any gooder than that, does it? And how does he save people? By exacting revenge, paying them back, getting even, settling the score. Was he going to do that to the Dirty Dozen, these characters? No. You see, from their very line, there would be one like them in every way except for sin. And he would die in their place. And they will be forgiven and pardoned because he never sinned. When he was reviled, he didn't revile back.
He never snarled, he never gritted his teeth, he never clenched his fist, and I'll get you. Oh, I'll get you. It's the very opposite. When he looked over that city that would crucify him, he wept. If they'd only known what he had for them. And you see, this gospel is a gospel where God does get even, where he settles the score in his Son. What a marvelous gospel. And when you've been forgiven like that, you can forgive. We're not playing games. We're not psychologically fooling around with ourselves. Only faith can make you face the facts that it was terrible, it was wrong, it was evil. They intended to hurt you. But God and no one else has the last word. And when he speaks grace, boy, it's good. Because it winds up saving many people. Amen.